Welcome to Life, Lemons and the Law, a podcast from Clark Wilmot. This series of the podcast is all about social mobility, which is the link between the circumstances in which you grow up and the outcomes that you can expect in terms of income and career. Now, as we've heard on the podcast so far in this series, the issues of social mobility profoundly affect young people across the UK, and that's why Clark Wilmot is partnered with the Social Mobility Foundation to formally support young people and to try and improve social mobility. Now, on this episode, we have Tom Costin and Ryan Rahim, both of whom have been affected by these issues. And we're also going to look at some other obstacles to social mobility, learning difficulties such as dyslexia, dyspraxia, and ADHD, as well as, vitally, language and accent. So, Ryan and Tom, can I get you to introduce yourselves? Tom, maybe you can start.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I work within Clark Wilmot. I am an IT trainer. We onboard every new starter to the firm, support them, throughout their career journey.
So, my question for you, Ryan, tell us a little bit about what you do.
I have recently qualified as a solicitor. I work in our Taunton team, in our business recovery unit, otherwise known as debt recovery unit. I'm also involved with our community team dedicated to maintain the commitments that we made since we have partnered with the Social Mobility Foundation, actively helping them in any way I can.
Tom, what did you want to be career-wise when you were growing up?
I'm fairly certain at one point it was definitely a pilot. I wanted to be a fighter pilot for the RAF. And then I got my glasses, so that couldn't happen. But then as I started going through secondary school, started learning more about the world of work and the world of careers, I wanted to become a lawyer.
Can you remember what it was about law that appealed to you back then?
It was about making a change. I'd always been quite observant of the world around me. And I think even from a fairly young age, I'm not from the nicest of places in the world, especially not the nicest of places in the UK. And I'd noticed that maybe life wasn't quite as fair for everyone as it should be. Maybe there was a lot of people that were suffering. There was a lot of issues. And as much as it's so cliche to sit there and go, I wanted to put the world right, you look at it through the eyes of a sort of 12, 13, 14-year-old who's suddenly starting to see things that maybe they don't like around them. Yeah, there was a sense of, I wanted to be able to make a change to things. Not only that, though, it's a fancy career, right? When you look at it through the eyes of a teenager, it's fancy suits and shouting at people in court.
Yeah, 100%.
To be honest, I did not have any clue what I wanted to be. I was always a daydreamer. The challenges started when I was two. I did not have the parents. I lost my parents and then I was adopted. When I went to school, I just refused to speak. I really struggled to speak. I think I was 6, 7, being laughed at very often because I muddled up with the words. So I was quite embarrassed and I refused to speak. I was made to feel like that I was just a stupid person, less intelligent. I wasn't clever enough to go to school. I really, really struggled. I never imagined that I would be a lawyer. I had my own way to learn things. Very often I needed a very quiet place by myself, and a very kind teacher actually understood that and allowed me to do that study that way. So I think without him, I wouldn't be probably able to finish primary school.
Do you think, we've discussed before, but we've talked about how different learning styles maybe weren't understood in both of our backgrounds. And it's quite interesting because we were both disruptors. I used to read ahead of the class. I'd get bored and read ahead and then get even more bored because I'd finish the books and then disrupt the classes, which then led to me, you know, the teachers would kick me out of lessons and I spent many, many hours looking at the hallways in my school. That deeply impacted my academical growth as well because I thought, well, learning isn't for me. Did you have the same sort of realization where you went, well, learning's not for me then? Maybe this isn't right. Maybe this is something I should be doing.
Definitely. I felt like I hated a class. I hated being in that environment and that kind of the way they were teaching me. And I can remember hiding under the bench. It wasn't for me. And I massively struggled. So people, including teachers, should understand that there are not one ways to learn. There are many ways to learn. As I said, there's a repeating, the copying, acting, analyzing. There are many ways you can learn. And if we don't open those doors, I think there are lots of young broken souls will fail.
Almost all of my lessons that I can think of failed to engage me, and I failed to engage with them because there was a lack of understanding, or at least a lack of relation to this kid's learned it, understood it, and is ready to move on. How can we engage that? How can we support that? And instead it became he's just being disruptive, just remove him from the class. It left me with a real distaste for, and a real disrespect, unfortunately, for educators, which took me quite a few years to get past. It resulted in me having a complete distaste for education, thinking this is not for me. Clearly education isn't where I'm supposed to be.
You know, we mentioned the fact that you were interested in the law and you saw that as being an opportunity to right wrongs, etc. Did that fade from your ambitions? And what did you take on when you left school?
So when I finished school, jumped straight to college, I took A-levels, history, psychology, sociology, and law, which when you mention to anyone about those A-levels, especially in that order, they go, wow, that's quite a hefty workload. There were some issues. There were a lot of social issues that I had at the time. And my parents, unfortunately, were going through quite a hefty divorce, which culminated in me not having anywhere to live. One thing led to another. I don't necessarily blame anyone, but it meant that by about 16, nearly 17, I had to find my own place to live, which meant that I wasn't able to resume college anyway, because at that point it's get a job, start paying bills. Unfortunately, in the town I'm from, or a town I lived in at the time, without a college education and without anything else, you've got two fields of work. You either go into hospitality or you go into care work. That's it. There's nothing else in that town. So I went and became a chef. I went and jumped feet first into another career entirely.
Ryan, you are a practicing lawyer. Was there a turning point at which things became less difficult and you realized that your ambitions were achievable?
Yes. So being 15 years old, I think I can remember my parents are really struggling with the money. I was into physics and math. I understood the mathematical language. So I wanted to be a physics or math teacher or a scientist. Then my parents said, look, we can't afford for you to do science. So it was a turning point for me, and I had to find something else that I wanted to do. Then my far related uncle sent me a pro bono work. A girl needed rescuing, a girl who was an acid victim, completely burned. Her husband was the perpetrator. The lawyer who was working for us was brilliant, but that wasn't enough. At that point, I made lots of noise, and her story was allowed to go onto a local newspaper. Politicians got involved, the lawmakers got involved, and we managed to rescue the girl. And that was the turning point. I was quite motivated. I just wanted to do the law and help people. And I think that being a lawyer is one of the professions that we always there to help people.
So was it plain sailing after that moment at which you understood you wanted to be a lawyer? Was it easy from then on?
No, it wasn't. I went to a university in Bangladesh where I done a law degree, and that wasn't enough for me. I've been extremely lucky, extremely unlucky I had in my life, and found out that I was entitled to money which could allow me to come to Britain and be a barrister. So my mum left a trust fund for me. With their help, I came to Britain to be a lawyer. But when I came to Britain, it was a massive struggle. When I went to the uni accommodation, there were people like me. At least they shared the same color of skin. And they started giving me name, and the name was Freshie. Freshie means the person who fresh off the boards coming to the UK illegally. They're saying, bro, you sounds proper Freshie, bro. What they mean, I realized later on, I had a very thick accent, and I still have. You can hear that. And that accent was an issue. When I finished my law degree, I had two sets of law degree. I would send lots of CVs, applications, for training contract. I would not have any response. I realize that very often my white fellow students, they will just ignore me. And they played a very dominant role in class activities. I realized that actually having that accent, having that language is quite important.
Tom, you mentioned that there is two options for you, care or catering, in the town that you grew up if you didn't have the qualifications that you wanted. I know that you went into catering. Did you, although a successful career in catering was beckoning, it's not what you do now. So did you always harbor ambitions to move from catering?
Absolutely. There was no such thing as an old, cheerful chef. They just don't exist. Everyone that gets put hits a certain point. And so I looked ahead, and as much as I was trapped into it for nearly 10 years, it was always that thing of, I need an out. As life goes, there's always that Indiana Jones style rolling ball behind you of bills, rents, overwhelming fear of debts and so on that was always chasing me. So a good chef salary is sort of 34K thereabouts. I was earning as a head chef. You try changing industry to earn that same kind of money with no qualifications, no background in anything else. It's incredibly difficult. I was working for a charity. It was my last job within the catering industry. I spent 3 years working for the Royal British Legion. And then they closed the area of the business that I worked in. I used that as my catalyst to go, okay, let's change industry. Let's just do something else. I managed to break into a call center for airport taxis. Did really, really well in that job, managed to push through and get some good references under my belt, managed to force my way through into another admin job for a luxury plumbing company. And not long after that, I managed to move up to Bristol and I managed to land a job with Samsung. Always loved tech as well. And I think in the ideal world, if I could, I'd be sort of working in the tech side of the law. It would be magical to me if I could. And managing to land a job with Samsung was the real pioneering change. Then managed to move across to a financial tech company. So I was really, really getting these accolades under my belt, all the while sitting in these offices surrounded by people who are significantly more qualified than me. Just sort of thinking, God, are they gonna look? Sooner or later, someone's going to turn around and go, hang on, you're not meant to be here. I'm still terrified now. I'm sat here right now on the 11th floor in Clark Wilmot, surrounded by highly, highly qualified professionals. I'm still I'm scared that one of them is going to open the door here and go, are you meant to be here?
So you wanted to be a lawyer when you were younger. You studied law at A-level until you jacked it in because of the circumstances that you mentioned previously. Is it an accident that you're at Clark Wilmot, Tom?
No, absolutely not. This is another, I mean, it's such a long roundabout way of getting to it. But I figured when I saw the job come up, I thought, well, you know what? What better way to try and get myself closer to the law than to just surround myself with it? It's another tiny baby step getting myself closer. It's starting to build the contacts, build the understanding of how I can get to it and sort of scale this. In my mind, this, and it still is, this insurmountable wall, this mountain that's ahead of me of maybe one day I can work alongside these people. It made it a reality. And even now, I've got lawyers 2 meters away from me having conversations about very important things. Again, as mentioned, I've still got that permanently rolling ball of financials and, you know, the day-to-day living costs. And there's an avenue. It's a small avenue from my perspective. And honestly, until I started getting involved with the Social Mobility Foundation, I actually thought it was a door that was still closed to me. I thought, this is as close as I'm ever going to get. And now after speaking with Ryan, speaking with some of the Social Mobility Foundation, and actually talking to some of the people that work within the field, I've suddenly started to realize that actually I might be able to find my way into it.
You will. Yes, Tom, I think you should, and definitely don't give up. As I said before, if you're really, really that passionate, never give up. If I can do it, you can do it. We are here to help you.
It's the door opening thing. It's that realization. And I spent so many years, half of my life, thinking that something like this was just completely unattainable. There was absolutely no chance I would ever even remotely be able to consider a university degree. And it's a real stark contrast when you start mixing in with people who a university degree to them is just something they've got. It's just something that everyone does. And you sit there and it's almost like you've got a hollow foundation. It's just something that's completely alien to me. I don't even have the A-levels to be able to begin to start looking at a university degree. I could apply, I'd get rejected because I don't have the UCAS points. It's that insurmountable barrier that I thought existed. And up until very, very recently, I thought there's absolutely no way this can happen. And there's a small story I love to recount from when I was in secondary school. We're going through a social education lesson and we were talking about politics. And I remember saying at the time, I was like, oh, I wouldn't mind doing that. Politics sounds all right. Sounds like a great career. And my social education teacher turned around to me and went, I'm going to be honest with you, Tom. You're probably not rich enough to get into politics. I wouldn't bother. It's a loser's game for someone from your kind of background. That has stuck with me for, well, 16, 17 years. And for that message being received at a young age to say, you can't do that, is what's been so prevalent and one of the reasons why I want to get so heavily involved with the Social Mobility Foundation.
Definitely. I mean, it took me 17 years to be qualified as a lawyer. It's 17 years. And I am still a small fish in a big pond. I'm very open about my challenges that I face and I continue to face. Until I came here and started my law degree, I was diagnosed with dyslexia and ADHD and dyspraxia. But I did not know what dyslexia was, what dyspraxia and ADHD were. When I found out my struggles and why my brain, the way it works, it is empowering in a way. Because then I found out, okay, it's just not me. There are other people. They're dyslexic lawyers. They're dyslexic businessmen.
How much impact do you think it would have had? Because I've asked myself this question a lot, but how much impact do you think it would have had if you'd have known that there were other people with the same issues? Do you think it would have vastly improved your understanding of yourself and the way you learn if you knew there were people out there with the same issues?
Yeah, definitely. There are lots of stigma attached to it. If I had that understanding from the very beginning, it would definitely change the way I struggle. I don't think it would take 17 years for me to be qualified as a solicitor.
I suppose it brings it nicely into the Social Mobility Foundation, what we're hoping to do. I would love to find someone who was in the same boat as I was, just getting pushed down constantly, just getting told, you can't do this because you're poor. Is the nub and crux of it is that is where I was from age sort of 11 up to, you know, even a few years ago, is looking at things going, the amount of money I have in my bank account or don't and still don't is your barrier. For yourself, it was the issues that you had with the way that you learn. It was your barrier. I would love the opportunity to be able to find people with the same barriers as we had.
I think the person is in front of me too, because dyslexia, dyspraxia, my disability wasn't the only issues that I faced. When I came to this country, within a couple of years, I ran out of money, ran out massively. My parents are not that rich. My dad in a small business, pottery business, and he could not send me any more money. So there was a risk that I could not finish my law degree. I had to do a top-up degree to practice and to be qualified as an English lawyer. The law degree that I'd done in Bangladesh wasn't enough. So I wasn't getting any job. I even applied for legal admin jobs and I wasn't getting anywhere. And then for 3-4 months, I was living on just biscuits and Sainsbury's energy drinks. And I was saving every bit of money that I was earning. LPC, I can still remember, £11,640 I had to gather to the next bit of qualifications, which I did not have.
£11,000 is insane amounts of money for people that don't have that big income or a comfortable place to live, or people who have to pay rent and who are working for a low wage. I mean, the lower wages, and even when I was younger, were £21,000. £11,000 off that. Okay, what do I eat? Where do I live? How do I access this route? I can't afford to. Even now, if I wanted to say, okay, let's go to university, let's go and try and get a qualification, I don't have that kind of money. It's insurmountable. That figure right there is the reason why we're seeing such a disparity in the economic backgrounds of the people that are joining the legal industry. That number is, from my perspective, the problem. I can't afford that.
I mean, that's back then, 2016. It's more than that now. You're talking about £18,000, which is a huge amount of money. I was trying to save, how desperate I was. I was going to places to my friends, and I said, can I stay here for a week or so? I wasn't eating a proper meal. Luckily, I met my wife, and she kind of looked after me. I was extremely lucky, as I said, and she understood the problems that I was going through and how passionate I was. I came to this country to do law, and I didn't want to give up. When I was doing my legal practice course in a networking event, I met one person. She was a trainee solicitor. Gave me the connection, created opportunity for me basically to do a week work experience with Clark Wilmot. I went to Bristol office. I worked with our previous managing director, Philippa Hunt. She was brilliant. She knew that I didn't have any work experience, but the way she welcomed me with the biggest smile, she was a partner, very busy, and I was just a work experience guy. I was so happy in the sense that actually somebody, not knowing who I am, trusted me immediately and gave me the opportunity. She opened the door, and I think that is the moment I felt like, okay, I can do it, and the door just opened for me.
A final question, if you don't mind, to both of you. What needs to change to improve social mobility that you can see in 2024?
It shouldn't matter who you are. It should matter what you're able to do. And the approach that education takes, especially in secondary, I cannot emphasize this enough. My secondary school was not in a wealthy area. My secondary school did as best as it could to kick it out of me that I wasn't gonna enter a career that I really wanted to. And then I went to my college, and my college went, yeah, if you can't quite keep up, or if it's not quite working for you, or if your life's getting in the way, off you go. That's what needs to change. It needs to be understood that just because you're 15, just because you're 11, just because you're 12, life outside of education is just so heavily impactful. And those are the formative years. Those are the years where you're really going to build who you are. And the support needs to be better.
It's easy to describe social mobility with the poverty, lack of diversity, and income gaps, etc., but it's only part of a story. The other part, which is harder to define, and I learned the effect of using language, more importantly, how you sound, it is quite important, especially if you want to be a lawyer. I realized this from the very beginning when I came to this country and I was applying hundreds of applications I made and I wasn't getting anywhere. I have been desperately trying to lose my accent and I continue to do so. You know, language is the heart of the social mobility story in Britain. Young people or people like me from different backgrounds, from different countries, should be given opportunity to speak the language of the elite institution. But we should also depart from the damaging idea that there is one single right form of language. We must all challenge one another, not to be guided by prejudice and not judge one how they sound, but what they're saying, and perhaps an extra effort to understand why they are saying it. And I think it is important to be kind, be genuine when you're offering help, be genuine about it. Everyone should go back and try and open the door, the opportunity for others.
Thank you very much indeed, both of you. Thanks, Tom. Thanks, Ryan.
Yeah, perfect. Thank you, everyone.
No, thank you.
If you'd like to find out more about the Social Mobility Foundation and Clark Wilmot's work in this area, you'll find the links in the show notes. Please do like and subscribe, etc. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.